You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
What is it in the nature of man that makes us hate and cheat and steal and kill? Why do people get off on bigotry, intolerance, and racial intolerance?
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Gary Clayle and Human Nature from the album Emotional Hooligan. In keeping with our focus on sustainability projects going on around the country, we'll hear today from Lisa DiPiano of Northampton, Massachusetts business Pedal People, a municipal trash collection effort running on people power with bicycles. We'll also hear from Frances Crow, who for all her adult life has been an activist for peace. She talks about her early efforts to counsel Vietnam-era troops about the draft and how she brought Amy Goodman's show Democracy Now! To Northampton, Massachusetts. It involved pirate radio on the local hilltop and eventually convinced the local community to divert funds that would normally have gone to their local radio station. But first, though, let's do some news briefs from around the world. In Peru, indigenous Indians have been blocking roads, waterways, and the state oil pipeline intermittently since April, demanding Peru's government repeal laws they say make it easier for foreign companies to exploit their lands. Indians protesting oil and gas exploration on their lands battle peace in Peru's remote Amazon on Friday, June 5th, with authorities and Indian leaders separately reporting 9 police and 25 protester deaths. The violence broke out before dawn as officers broke up a road blockade by some 5,000 Indians in an area called Curva de Diablo, or Devil's Curve, in the northern province of Utcubamba. Protest leaders said police opened fire from helicopters with bullets and tear gas, while National Police Director Jose Sanchez Farfan said protesters attacked officers with firearms and set fire to government buildings. He said 9 police officers were killed by gunfire and 45 wounded. On the other hand, indigenous leader Servando Puerta said 25 Indians were killed in the clash that they designed as a peaceful protest. Another 50 were injured and 14 of those seriously. The central government's public ombudsman office said it could only confirm the death of 5 Indians. Peruvian President Alan Garcia wants to ramp up foreign oil investment in the Amazon, and he has implemented the Peru-U.S. Free Trade Pact. Indians say he has illegally opened communal jungle lands and water resources to oil drilling, logging, mining, and large-scale farming. In addition to violating Peru's constitution, indigenous groups say Garcia is breaking international law by not obtaining their consent. Garcia defends the laws as the need to help Peru develop. The government owns all subsoil rights in the Andean country, and Garcia has vigorously fought to exploit its mineral resources. A Duke University study published last year said contract blocks for oil and gas exploration cover approximately 72% of Peru's rainforest. And although Peru's economic growth has led Latin America recently, Garcia's critics say little wealth has trickled down in a country where roughly half the population is indigenous and the poverty rate tops 40%. Big news in Nigeria. After a 14-year personal journey for Ken Wiwa Jr., son of the executed leader and writer Ken Sarawiwa, the oil giant Shell has agreed to pay $15.5 million in the settlement of a legal action in which it was accused of having collaborated in the execution of Ken Sarawiwa and 8 other leaders of the Ongoni tribe of southern Nigeria. Among the other plaintiffs was Kerololo Kogbara, who lost an arm after she was shot by Nigerian troops when she protested against the bulldozing of her village in 1993 to make way for a Shell pipeline. In the lawsuit, the families of the Ongoni Nine alleged Shell conspired with military government to capture and hang the men. Shell was also accused of a series of other alleged human rights violations, including working with the army to bring about killings and torture of Ongoni protesters. Supporters of the legal action said the fact that Shell had walked away from the trial suggested the company had been anxious about the evidence that would have been presented had it gone ahead. Stephen Kretzmann, director of Oil Change International, said Shell knew the case was overwhelming against them, so they bought their way out of a trial. Among the documents lodged with the New York court was a 1994 letter from Shell in which it was agreed to pay a unit of the Nigerian army for services rendered. The unit had retrieved one of the company's fire trucks from the village of Korokoro, an action that, according to reports at the time, left one Ongoni man dead and two wounded. Shell wrote it was making payments, quote, as a show of gratitude and motivation for the sustained favorable disposition in future assignments. Shell's involvement in the oil-rich Niger Delta extends back to 1958. It remains the largest oil business in Nigeria, owning some 90 oil fields across the country. The Ogoni people began nonviolent agitation against Shell in the early 1990s under the leadership of Ken Saro-Wiwa and his organization, Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. Mosop complained that the oil giant was responsible for devastating the ecosystem of the Delta. Out of the $15.5 million settlement, $5 million will be used to set up a trust to support education and other initiatives in the Niger Delta. In a recent report, head of the Military Expenditure Project at Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, Sam Perler-Friedman, said global military spending surged to a record $1.464 billion last year, with the U.S. maintaining its position as the world's leading arms spender. U.S. military expenditure rose 9.7% to $607 billion, accounting for 42% of the total global arms spending. China became the world's second biggest military buyer, increasing its spending by 10% to an estimated $84.9 billion last year. France overtook Britain to become the world's third biggest arms spender, while Russia climbed to fifth place from seventh in 2007. Other countries such as India, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Israel, Brazil, South Korea, and Algeria also contributed substantially to the total increase. Arms shipment rose 4% worldwide from 2005 and 45% higher than in 1999. According to SIPRI, about 8,400 operational nuclear warheads were held in global military stockpiles. Of those, almost 2,000 were kept on high alert and capable of being launched within minutes. About 23,300 nuclear weapons were held in the arsenals of eight states: the United States, Russia, China, Britain, France, India, Pakistan, and Israel. A SIPRI spokesman said that the idea of the war on terror has encouraged many countries to see their problems through a highly militarized lens, using this to justify high military spending. The following interview with Lisa DiPiano was conducted in May in Northampton, Massachusetts. Lisa is part of the growing sustainability movement around the world. She is part of the collectively owned and managed business Pedal People, a municipal trash collection effort powered by people on bicycles. With me today is Lisa DiPiano of Northampton, Massachusetts, Pedal People. We're going to hear about what Pedal People is, and we're going to hear the kinds of innovative things that are going on in Northampton, Massachusetts. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you, because I was really struck yesterday when I learned that you have something here called Pedal People. And in fact, what you do is you're the trash collection system.
That's right. We started about 6 years ago, and we're a 12-member worker-owned collective. We go around the city just like any other truck service would, and we pick up trash, recycling, and compost. And so we do this all with bicycles and bike trailers.
So are these special bicycles and special trailers?
The trailers are special. They're made by Bikes at Work, and they can handle up to 300 pounds. So we can really load up a bunch of garbage and recycling on the back of the trailers. And you can use any kind of bicycle. It comes with a special hitch that you attach to any mountain bike or road bike, so any bike could be able to pull this amount of weight.
It seems not something you would think of doing easily, because it sounds to me like a big job. So how did this come about?
It's an interesting story. One of our founders, founded by two people, Alex and Ruthie, and Ruthie was a bike messenger in Chicago. And so she came to this town, and she started taking her own trash and recycling by bicycle. And so she was taking it, and then one of her friends said, oh, would you mind taking mine? And so it just kind of evolved. She thought, okay, this could be a viable business option. And so what they did, you know, we're in New England and their winters are very, very rough here. So they said, if we could start out in the winter, we could see if we could really do it and haul trash all through the year, through every single season and weather condition. So they started out in the winter, and that was 6 years ago. And at first, nobody thought that we could outstand the New England winters, but we have, and we've been going strong. We now have over 400 customers, including the whole city of Northampton, where we pick up the municipal trash off of the street.
And when you say we, you're talking about a group of how many?
There's 12 of us. We're worker owners of the company, and so we don't have a boss. We all run the business together, and we make decisions as a group.
And how does that work?
Let's see. We have bi-weekly meetings, and we have an agenda just like any other business. And so we make decisions using the consensus model, where somebody will raise a proposal and we'll discuss it and answer any questions. And we view people have conflicts about the decision. We'll hear them out and we'll try to resolve them and to alter the proposal so it makes sense to everyone. So we look at and view conflict as a way to make the decision stronger. And we want everybody to be a part of the decision, to really believe in it.
Well, this is something that always fascinates me, because I do a lot of political work and I find that we're often quite at odds with some of the decisions. And what I find is that people tend then to back away instead of get into the conflict and really try and resolve it. So I'd be really fascinated if you could give us an example of something that has been sticky and then has gotten worked out.
Well, there's been certain decisions, like we just made a big decision to reorganize the way that we do the trash pickups by breaking them down by day and regions. And so that meant for each of our pedal people routes to be totally deconstructed and reconstructed. So it was a really big decision that had a huge impact on the business. And most people were on board, and we had a couple people that weren't. And so, you know, oftentimes...
And they were, why weren't they?
I think they had reasons. They didn't think it was necessary, or they were used to the way that their route was going and they didn't really want to alter it that much.
Okay.
And so we really listened to all of their concerns. And, you know, oftentimes it's like, okay, is this just bullying in? If there's one person that feels strongly enough, are they going to stop the decision from happening since we all have to agree to it? Or they could just decide to say, you know what, I feel this way, but most of the group feels the other way, so I'm not going to block it from going through. And so eventually we talked it out and worked it out, and the person that didn't want to do that understood the reasons why other people did and eventually decided that it was okay.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes if it's a consensus, the person that has been feeling most uncomfortable about it or continues to feel that way and feels a little resentful. But that's something that you've managed to work out, it sounds like. Part of it is sticking with it for a long time until everything is surfaced, right?
Right. So it's the idea that I think about a lot is you're making a decision that will be, in the long term, more sustainable, because people have really had that chance to really talk about it and get their feelings out about it and hash through it. So it might seem like it takes longer in the beginning. But oftentimes with other decisions I've been a part of is you can make a quick decision, then something comes up, everybody turns out not everybody really agreed with it, and then you spend time rehashing it later on. So for us, we spend a lot of time, and you know, not most decisions are pretty easy and pretty quick, but some of these bigger decisions, it does take time, but we find that it pays off in the end because everybody feels as though their voice has been heard and they've had a chance to weigh in and really say what they had to say. And so the decision will stick.
Well, thanks for going into that, because as I say, here on Raising Sand, this is one of the things that we try and get at, is the difficulties that we go through to try and create a new world. But it's never really easy right off the bat, especially when you're trying to really change minds. So let's go back to the bicycling now. You have 12 people in the group. Are new people coming in?
We've gotten a lot of demand from all over the country, people seeing what we're doing and wanting to start up similar models in their home communities. And so we're kind of slowing down at around 12 right now. We went from about 5 members to 12 in just a couple of years. So we've really seen a tremendous amount of growth. And so we don't want to grow, get too big. We don't want too many customers and to make generating too much income. We want to actually just help other people start similar businesses for themselves. And kind of part of what we do is lessening the amount of work that we have to do. We don't want to work an 8 or 9 hour day. And with this kind of lifestyle, you know, we work really hard for about 3 to 4 hours, but then we have extra time to give back to our community, doing volunteer projects or farming or playing music and other things that really make our lives very rich and full. Mm-hmm. So right now we're focusing on how do we start other businesses? How can other people start similar businesses using their bicycle, using human power to help themselves do what they really want to do and maybe get out of that 9-to-5 grind and really explore some of their different dreams.
And have a different kind of quality of life. Mm-hmm. And where do you take the garbage that you pick up?
Well, we're really fortunate. The city of Northampton has just been wonderful to work with. And we haul it about 3 miles to the transfer station. And so we take the recycling and trash to the transfer station where it's consolidated. The trash then goes to the landfill and the recycling goes to Springfield, Massachusetts, where it's broken down and then shipped off. The compost, we started a compost program about 2 years ago where we're the only organization in the city, only trash haulers that will actually pick up organic waste. And that then goes back to a farm that we helped co-found, and the materials get mixed in with leaves and it generates really nice compost that the farm then uses to grow their vegetables.
We're talking to Lisa DiPiano about Pedal People here in Northampton, Massachusetts. It's a really innovative way of putting people to work with a quality of life that's really sustainable, as well as taking care of the earth. And let's talk a little bit about that farm. You mentioned you were part of the co-founding group.
It's called the Montview Neighborhood Farm. And so what we did is, just like we're using human power in the trash system, we thought, wow, let's look at the way that our food is produced and how heavily it's reliant on fossil fuels, all the way from the chemicals that are sprayed on it that are petrochemicals, to shipping it, to the tractors that are used in growing the food. So we really saw how fossil fuel was really key in every single stage. And so we thought, what can we do to create a new model so we're not dependent upon these fossil fuels or foreign oils to get sustenance for our life? And so we worked with the city to gain access to conservation land that's permanently protected. And we started a human-powered organic CSA farm, community-supported agriculture farm, where we're growing food using methods, no-till methods, where we don't use tractors, we use hand tools, and we grow food for the surrounding neighborhood. And the neighborhood then can walk or bike to pick up their produce.
And I'm actually sitting right here looking out of the window over one of these farms, and it's really quite beautiful because it's very green. It's suddenly just popped, I guess, spring popped in Northampton. It's also good to know that there's this calmness in people's lives around here because of the lack of tractor noise, for example.
It's interesting because we are, you know, it's a nice juxtaposition because we're located right by I-95, a huge busy highway. And so we are kind of nestled in this neighborhood. And around the farm, there's larger farms that grow food that gets shipped out for potatoes and corn and that kind of thing. So I really like that model because we're doing something different amidst all these other farms that are doing more conventional farming. So you can see just how different what we're doing is. But there's still that common bond where we've been working in conversation with a lot of the other farmers in the area. And people are excited. Old farmers are excited to see this new wave of interest in growing food and are glad that the land is still being used to generate food in this way and not going for big condo developments or other things like that.
And is it the same people as Pedal People that are involved in the farming, or is that a different group, a different community?
It's some similar people. Some of the same people are involved in both. And it's great because we have Pedal People deliveries with the organic food waste, mm-hmm. and they come to the compost pile and help turn it and manage that. And a lot of our inputs and outputs are done through bicycle. So anytime we want to haul water or tools or anything like that, most of it is done through bicycles.
Haul water?
We do. We don't have a well on site. So a lot of times we'll transport. We do some rainwater collection on site, but oftentimes we'll haul water in the bins. We have special bins that we use for water, and we can transport it that way.
That's amazing. Those are as heavy as the big trash bins, I would imagine. 300 pounds or so. I mean, water is heavy.
Water, what is it, like 10 pounds for every gallon, something like that.
Wow. Listeners can go to pedalpeople.com to learn more about it. What else would you like people to know about this project?
Oh, just that the human body has a large potential, and I've seen just changes in my body, just getting back, being physical, and just the amount that I can do has changed. And so I remember that one television show where people went back to colonial times or something like that, just to see if they could do it, and they couldn't. They couldn't even chop enough wood to survive through a winter. So I think that we have a lot of potential as human beings that we just haven't really tapped into that much. So it would just, you know, challenge people to have the courage to be imaginative and to live lives that they want to do with other people, and to find other people that have similar interests, and to venture out together.
Lisa, did you think when you were, you know, a teenager or in college that this was a direction you were going in?
Oh, definitely not. I went to college, I went to graduate school, and now, you know, I'm hauling trash. So it's definitely...
What did you study in grad school?
I studied regional planning, city planning. So now, instead of sitting in office 9 to 5, I feel like I'm on the ground implementing the changes that I would have created policy about.
And is that true of the other people in your group?
It varies. You know, we have a former Marine that's a pedal person. We've got people who have master's degrees, people that never went to college. So there's a bunch of variation in the group.
That was Lisa DiPiano of Pedal People in Northampton, Massachusetts. You're invited to email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org if you know of other innovative businesses investing in sustainable alternative business. Let us know and we'll run those. This is an important topic to be alerting people to.
Was it Cesar Chavez? Maybe it was Dorothy Day. Some have said Dr. King or Gandhi sent them on their way. No matter who your mentors are, it's pretty plain to see. If you've been to jail for justice, you're in good company. Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand. Sitting in and laying down our ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Oh, you're a friend of mine.
That's Annie and the Vets with Have You Been to Jail for Justice, and opening our next segment with Frances Crowe, who has been an activist for peace all of her adult life. She's 90 years old, and in this pre-recorded interview talks about what she was doing when the atomic bombs were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, her early efforts to counsel Vietnam-era troops about the draft, and how she brought Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now!, to Northampton, Massachusetts. It involved pirate radio on the local hilltop and eventually raising funds that normally would have gone to the local radio station.
I'm Frances Crowe. I am 90 years old. I came to Northampton in 1851. We moved here to send our son to the Clark School for the Deaf. It's a very good oral school for the deaf. He was born profoundly deaf, and it was a really good place to come. We lived across the street from the school so that he could have the advantage of family life and the very best oral education. So he has good language, speech, and cochlear implants now. Mm-hmm. He's a marine biologist. And my life really was defined and changed greatly with Hiroshima. I supported World War II. I was caught up in Pearl Harbor and the dominant media then. But I had been questioning things, I think, for a long time, growing up in Missouri. And by the time we dropped the bomb in Hiroshima, I, you know, knew almost instantly that war was wrong. And so I've been working since to try to stop war.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about how that was presented in the newspapers.
It wasn't. And my husband was planning to go into radiology, and he was a physician then in the Army. And we were living in New Orleans, and he was on a transport that was coming into New Orleans once a month. And he was very interested in x-rays and radiation. And he had heard scuttlebutt within the Army that we were working to split the atom and develop this horrible weapon. And so I was alone in New Orleans at the time, but I knew when I heard on the radio what had happened, that we had done it. And so there was very little in the press, and there was great celebration and jubilation of the end of the war, and we just couldn't relate to that at all because we knew what would happen. And it wasn't really until John Hershey came out with his New Yorker article about really what had happened before the American people were aware. But that was about 2 years. I'm not certain. But Alfred Bruchette was doing reports. He came down from China. He was the Guardian reporter and went into Hiroshima and wrote stuff. And I had been living in New York and was reading the Guardian and a newspaper, PM, that came out every day then. It was a wonderful little four-page paper that presented an alternative point of view. So I had ways of picking up news. And also, we went to Rochester, where my husband was going to do a residency in radiology, and it was one of the bases of the Manhattan Project. And I remember going to the first sort of faculty reception and thinking, you know, I'll find people here interested and we can begin to organize here. Well, after that reception, I knew that was not fertile territory. Everybody was in deep denial. And you know, there was talk about atoms for peace. Only one person in Rochester I met at the medical school was really aware and would talk with me about alternative points of view.
So how was that for you?
It was very isolating. And
did you have a question? Maybe you were the one that was wrong?
No.
No,
don't think I ever question that.
I mean, because because culturally, that's what you're supposed to do, right?
Yes,
you're supposed
but
to
I think
in.
I'd always, as a child, I was a rebel. You know, I was questioning my parents, my culture, growing up in a small town in Missouri where people were very accepting of the government. And and there was a public hanging in town, you know, and this was south of the Mason-Dixon line. And my parents didn't support it, but we didn't talk about it because my father was in business. And, you know, and I was rebelling against all of that. I was looking for a society or a community where I could really talk about things. And so that when I finished college, I went to New York during World War II, and I supported World War II and felt I had to get involved in trying to do something, but I didn't feel good about the military. I couldn't accept that, and I couldn't accept the Red Cross. That was just, you know, entertaining soldiers. And so I read about in program that government was running, the Engineering Science Management War Training, to train women to go into industry to replace men. So that's where I ended up and worked for the Bilthoffer Laboratories in their personnel department, and was living at International House and doing graduate work at Columbia. But after a while, I left Columbia to go to the New School for Social Research, and from there, I went to the Jefferson School.
But then you met your husband, who was in the military.
I met him in college, and he went off when he finished his internship. But I'd met him in a discussion group because we were both Catholics, and we were trying to figure out kind of our relationship to the church. We were raising questions about whether or not Catholicism was the right answer for us. So that, you know, we met in trying to figure out the culture and our values. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's what our life was all about.
It really interests me to see how people find their way into thinking in a different way. And what I'm hearing is that we had some kind of an inkling anyway, but some people don't, and they find their way into a different way of thinking. Do you think that there's already a setup for people who are thinking a certain way, or is it possible for people to really change their minds, and what do you think that takes?
Well, I've thought a lot about order in the family. I was one of four girls, and my older sister was very obedient and followed what my mother told her to do. She rushed home from school to help my mother with the ironing.
Where were you in the order?
Second. And I wanted, you know, to get a bicycle and ride into the countryside and really explore. And so I've often thought about that. Yeah. What was your order in the family?
I was second, but the only girl.
Well, but I think often it's a second one who can find a new way of thinking. But, you know, it may be kind of a mutation in our thinking that we were permitted to find a new way to explore. Mm-hmm. I think it's very difficult in our culture now, even more than 30 years ago, because the media is so much more dominant. And I was particularly struck last week when I was watching the re-release of the film, the Jane Fonda film, Free the Army, because it is a film about the USO tour that was sponsored by our government to the military bases in the Pacific during the Vietnam War, where Jane Fonda and I think it was about a group of eight cultural workers, an integrated, wonderful group, went to Okinawa and Japan and Vietnam and the Philippines, all over the Pacific. And they did these programs and spoke out against the war much more forcefully, eloquently than anything going on now. And it was really, I think, the kind of final spark that began to end the war as the soldiers began to rebel and really refused to fight. And they weren't stopped by the government. Now, the film was not permitted to be shown in this country when they came back. And we're just now seeing the film. But I was struck with how obedient our culture, the people, are in the military, and that there isn't this rebellion that there was during the Vietnam War, because people are totally taken in by MSNBC, the dominant commercial media, which is totally bought out by the government.
The thing that amazes me still, though, about Vietnam is 58,000 troops died. 58,000!
Yes.
I mean, it's astonishing.
Yes.
And I guess it was on the news a lot for the first part.
Oh, yes. But, you know, we had senators like Wayne Morse and Gruning and Fulbright speaking out against it. And I was running a peace center down in the basement of my house where I was doing group draft counseling. It was what I called a feminist approach to counseling, where Tuesday and Thursday afternoons and Friday nights, I said, anyone who has questions about the war and the draft, come. We'll sit in a circle and we'll talk together what it is you're objecting to, and try to give you the law and help you find your way through this, and we'll support you in whatever you do. You know, it was very good because I was just totally involved. And when Wayne Morse appeared at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and it was on the evening news the next day, I had a big crowd. And I always had people, 8 or 10 every afternoon.
And civilians or military also?
Sometimes the military came, and the only way we knew, you know, who was in the military was the haircut. But, you know, we helped them. I counseled the first CO in the Air Force, and a lot of people got everybody who came, of all the people who came here, over 1,000 the first year, nobody went into the service. And everybody in the military who wanted to get out, got out in an open, honest way. I did not, I felt it was really wrong for people to lie on their physicals, that it would, you know, if you went to a psychiatrist and got a letter, you'd question the rest of your life, are you really sane? I thought if they weren't willing to kill, they were very sane. And the law says anyone who's opposed to participation in war in any form, facing them on moral, ethical, physical, or spiritual grounds, if you hold the moral, ethical objection with the same degree of intensity as one would hold a religious belief, you will not be drafted.
Well, you know, I trained and worked on what we call the GI Rights Hotline, which was kind of the same work that you were doing, and you really get to understand how the military works.
Oh, yes.
But there's a lot of coercion, and there's a lot of shuffling people to the side. It's very difficult to become a CO anymore.
Yes.
It's possible, but it takes about 2 or 3 years.
Oh, yes. Well, that was true for, you know, the work we were doing. It was not easy.
Yeah.
But the group was a big help, because the less articulate were helped by the more articulate, and those who were more in touch with their feelings were helped by, you know, could help those who were less in touch. And, you know, we knew who to send them to help them get letters for support. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, we had a community, and that was a big, big help. And then after they got where they wanted to go, then they came back and helped others. Oh. So that it, you know, it built up. In many ways, it was sort of the beginning, I feel, of the peace movement in Northampton. Mm. Because people, you know, were encouraged, and they continued to work.
How would you compare it to what's going on in the peace movement these days?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot going on. And although the major media doesn't tell us about it, if you're online, you know, there's a lot of support and help, particularly for young people who have the time to sit in front of the computer. And I think where you have democracy now on the radio and where you can really work to get people to listen to Democracy Now, it's, you know, it's a big challenge to get people addicted to listening to the radio and not turn on the commercial media. So where you can do that and be visible, I think you can make some headway. But I think the peace movement is not very effective. There's a lot of people who have, you know, a feeling about what's going on, but they're not hurrying enough yet. And they're busy trying to be happy and stylish and comfortable, which is what we're told all the time is the important thing. And this is a complicated society. It takes a lot of time to, you know, figure out all the rules and regulations and keep track of your credit card and your bank account and your taxes and all the other, you know, the license, the government, you know, all of these corporations make it sound very simple, but there's a lot of detail to living today. Yeah. So people are busy. And they're all in their separate, you know, steel coffins, I call cars, and so they can't talk to one another as you can, you know, if you are in a bus or a train.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I always say to people is that we need to argue with one another more, because we have this prohibition about talking about religion and politics.
Yes.
And I feel like it's an absolute death to your community if you're afraid to talk about those topics.
Exactly. If you're not involved in dialogue to talk about ideas and values, and there's very little talk about these things. I went to a play yesterday, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, that a friend of mine was in, and, you know, I was trying to talk at dinner about, you know, what the culture was and what was Albie really trying to say? What was the message? And most people didn't want to look at that. They, you know, are more intent on a more, I find, kind of a superficial look at things. So, yes, I think that the one effective resistance group, I think, in this country now, of course, is what Code Pink is doing, Medea Benjamin in Washington. And, of course, I think Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! And Pacifica Radio. I was at a conference Friday and Saturday with the Atlantic Life community. It's the resistance community resisting nuclear weapons that was started by Phil Berrigan and Liz McAllister. And we were talking about, you know, a lot of the people in the group have been involved in plowshare actions where they've taken a hammer and their blood to attack, you know, nuclear weapons and battleships and planes, and have served a long time, you know, 4 years or more in prison. Mm-hmm. And prison now is particularly difficult. And for lighter things, more symbolic actions, they won't even let you go to trial. The last five times I've been arrested, I haven't been permitted even, you know, they'll say they've dropped charges. They don't want you to speak your truth in the court. So it's very hard to find an avenue to get the word out. I was quite attracted to an article in the New Yorker a couple of weeks ago on David and Goliath. I mean, they're talking about finding the writer, the author of the article was talking about he was coaching a basketball team that his daughter was in, and they were the underdogs. But their strategy, of which I don't really understand yet, I've got to study it more, they ended up winning. So that, you know, that we have to develop a David strategy. We have to find totally new ways. Like, I think, for all of the plowshare actions, I think the pit stop plowshare action in Shannon, where maybe about 3 years ago, a group of people from Ireland blockaded a plane that was taking off to deliver war-making materials to Iraq. And they did some damage. It wasn't a lot of damage. But they went to trial, and they were acquitted. There were two trials. One was a mistrial, and the second one, they were acquitted. Well, you know, that was wonderful that they really stopped a weapon going to aid the war. And they, you know, they got two good juries. And how can we turn that, you know, to creative action in this country is what I think about a lot. And part of a shut it down affinity group of people opposing the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant, a dangerous old power plant up in Vernon, Vermont, that about 30 miles from here, that's had several breakdowns, and they want to, you know, expand its life. It should be shut down. And at a hearing recently, a woman who's been deeply involved in trying to shut down Vermont Yankee, she went, they wouldn't let her testify at the hearings and at the Vermont Nuclear Regulatory Commission hearings, and all, they had people from Energy, the company that has bought the power plant. They're very corrupt, giant corporations. She just took a bag of compost, and she threw some compost at them, and then put the compost in their water glasses and said, "This," you know, I thought it was a great gesture, a great action. She really expressed how she was feeling. And of course, and some of our group felt, oh, we should write a letter to the editor, you know, saying, this is not our style, we don't approve of this, and we are nonviolent actions, and she doesn't represent us. And I said, never, never. She acted on her conscience, and I cannot judge her conscience. But if that Nuclear Regulatory Commission got her feeling, great. You know, and these are the challenges, that people are so obedient and want to be so proper and so good that they have lost their passion for goodness. You know, that's what I loved about Phil Berrigan and some of the early resistors to the nuclear weapons. They didn't worry about the media. You know, they acted what was right on their deep religious convictions. And they felt they were doing God's work, and they were, you know, they did dangerous things. They walked, got onto battleships and out on docks where there were nuclear weapons. And
the whole nuclear discussion is kind of gone away at some level.
I know, and it's extremely serious now with Pakistan and India and all of these nuclear weapons, and we keep, you know, adding them and upgrading them. It's absolutely insane the amount of money and the dangers, and we have been so lucky.
This is KZSU Stanford, FM 90.1, and Raising Sand Radio with your host, Susan Gallimore, talking to Francis Crowe of Northampton, Massachusetts. I asked Francis to tell the story of how Democracy Now! Came to Northampton.
Well, I heard about Democracy Now! I heard Amy Goodman at 9/11 when I was up in Maine taking care of my grandchildren. And I determined to get it on the air in Northampton. So, you know, I came back and I tried National Public Radio, which I call National Pentagon Radio. And they said it wasn't their kind of programming for our local NPR station. So after, you know, trying very hard by petitioning and getting groups to go see them and going through all the channels, I finally ran into a co-conspirator, somebody who really knew how to do the technical things and actually was doing it from the top of Mount Holyoke, and it was going all over the valley. So,
this was pirate radio?
Yes. So then, you know, winter was coming, and I tried to get it so he wouldn't have to go to the top of the mountain, get it on in a tall building in Northampton, but no one was willing to do that. Everybody was afraid. So I said, well, let's try my backyard. So we threw the antenna up in a tree, and it worked. And so I put up a pole and bought a transmitter, and the co-conspirator downloaded it on his computer, and I picked it up from him and went on the air every day, 4:30 to 5:30, a nonviolent pirate for democracy.
And what kind of listenership did you get?
We got a lot of people addicted to Democracy Now! Mm. I had little cards made up, and I put them all over town and gave them out to people. Mm. And we were pretty open about it. And people started listening. And they really liked it, you know. And that was the only program we did, 4:30 to 5:30 every day. And so finally, then we had an alternative pledge campaign where we asked people to withhold their support for WFCR and say that they would pledge to give the money when they broadcast Democracy Now! And in 1 week, we had $40,000 withheld. Wow. So then WFCR called me up and said, let's talk. And they agreed that if I would stop broadcasting and that they would download it and send it over to UMass radio station. But I had to get UMass to agree to broadcast it, which took another year and a half. Wow. You know, for an old lady coming in and trying to get them to take an outside program, they thought, you know, that wasn't what they were used to doing. So after a year and a half, they finally agreed with, you know, a lot of help from many people in the community. We finally got Democracy Now! On the radio, and now they, the WMUA, the student radio station, loves it. It's brought in a lot more listeners. It's upgraded their station. They've raised a lot of money, and it's been very good for the station.
Do you think it was content that they were objecting to, or was it just that they wanted to say what was going to be on the air, and they objected to people telling them what to do?
I think it was content. Uh-huh. That they were afraid of. Uh-huh. And that's partially, and also students who didn't have much awareness, really, and were just interested in polka and sports. Mm-hmm. And weren't really open to new things.
New ideas, yeah.
And they didn't, and their leadership was timid. You know, they were frightened. They were into Homeland Security, I guess, and they weren't quite sure. So that, you know, I fault more than the students, the leadership.
No matter who your mentors are, it's pretty plain to see. If you've been to jail for justice, you're in good company.
This is our show for today. As usual, views expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Music, Human Nature with Gary Clail on the album Emotional Hooligan. And Have You Been to Jail for Justice by Annie and the Vets on the album Singing Peace to Power. Have a great weekend and join us again next week.
What is it that makes a man gaze down from his penthouse suites? Watching those young children sleeping rough on the street. Sometimes people do the strangest things.